If you look at a petrol car, for example, for every dollar of gasoline that you put in it, only around 20 cents actually goes towards turning the wheels. The other 80 cents is completely wasted as heat, right? You don't get any benefit from that whatsoever. When you're powering an electric car, it's almost the opposite. So for every dollar of electricity you use, 80 cents go towards turning the wheels and only 20 cents are lost. Now, what that means is that to travel the same distance in an electric car, you use 3 to 4 times less energy than you would in a petrol car. So these efficiency gains from electrification are really, really, really massive. And I think is one of the reasons why I think this transition is just, at this point, inevitable. The timescale is always debatable, but I think inevitable because we are just moving towards a much better system.
Imagine spending an hour with the world's greatest traders. Imagine learning from their experiences, their successes, and their failures. Imagine no more. Welcome to Top Traders Unplugged, the place where you can learn from the best hedge fund managers in the world so you can take your manager, due diligence, or investment career to the next level. Before we begin today's conversation, remember to keep two things in mind. All the discussion we'll have about investment performance is about the past, and past performance does not guarantee or even infer anything about future performance. Also understand that there's a significant risk of financial loss with all investment strategies, and you need to request and understand the specific risks from the investment manager about their product before you make investment decisions. Here's your host, veteran hedge fund manager, Niels Kastrup Larsen.
For me, the best part of my podcasting journey has been the opportunity to speak to a huge range of extraordinary people from all around the world. In this series, I have invited one of them, namely Kevin Coldiron, to host a series of in-depth conversations to help uncover and explain new ideas to make you a better investor. In the series, Kevin will be speaking to authors of new books and research papers to better understand the global economy and the dynamics that shape it so that we can all successfully navigate the challenges within it. And with that, please welcome Kevin Coldiron.
Thanks, Niels, and welcome, everybody. Our guest today is Dr. Hannah Ritchie. She's a senior researcher in the program on global development at Oxford University and deputy editor and lead researcher at Our World in Data, which is a wonderful online resource bringing together data on the world's largest problems and making them accessible to all of us. She also publishes an excellent Substack newsletter called Sustainability by Numbers, which I am an enthusiastic subscriber. And she joins us today to discuss her new book called Not the End of the World, How We Can Be the First Generation to Build a Sustainable Planet. And it's a book that I think perfectly fits in with the ideas that we're trying to profile on the show. It's data-driven. It gives a clear-eyed picture of the world as it is. And it gives us an optimistic way forward. So I'm really excited to have this conversation. Hannah, thanks so much for joining us and welcome to the show.
It's lovely to be here.
So you believe that your generation has the opportunity to be the first in human history that meets the needs of everyone alive and leaves the environment in a better place. It's not a guarantee. You're clear about that. You say it, but it's an opportunity. And it's a pretty exciting prospect. But you didn't always feel that way. In fact, it was only, I think, around a decade ago when you completed your degree where you said you found yourself in a state of kind of profound pessimism, so much so that you actually began looking for jobs in other fields outside of environmental science. And I was wondering if maybe you could just share with us the story of how you changed your mind about the prospects for building a sustainable future.
Yeah, of course. So my background is environmental science. So that's what I studied at university. I studied environmental geoscience and I studied carbon management, which is basically entirely focused on climate change. And then I also did a PhD on kind of food systems and environmental impacts of food. So my background is very, very environment heavy. And I think at the time when I was studying this stuff, everything just seemed to be getting worse and worse and worse, which is true. When you look at most environmental metrics that we might follow, they have been getting worse. And it seemed like kind of turning the curve on that would be really, really impossible. I think what I was also doing at that time was watching the news a lot. I think I had this notion that to be a responsible, informed citizen, I had to be watching the news all the time. Like I had to take on every single disaster that hit the headlines. And if I wasn't doing that, then I wasn't engaging properly with the problem and taking on other people's pain. So I think there was this combination of all of the data seemed to be getting worse and all of the headlines were just hitting me over and over and over. So yeah, I kind of got left in this place where I felt completely helpless to turn things around. I kind of was left with the notion that kind of I probably wouldn't have a good future ahead of me, and most young people wouldn't really get to kind of have the opportunities that our parents or our grandparents had. I think the problem I had at the time is that I was looking at these environmental metrics and I was also extrapolating them to kind of more human well-being, human progress metrics. So stuff like poverty levels or child mortality or life expectancy, hunger, even deaths from disasters. And I was extrapolating that and assuming all of this stuff was getting worse as well. Or at least that was what appeared to be the case when you were just looking at news headlines. And I think my perspective on that was kind of completely turned upside down when I discovered the work of a guy called Hans Rosling. Now, he was a Swedish physician and then kind of turned statistician. And what he'd do was he'd give these amazing like TED Talks and talks on big stages at like Google or the World Bank, where he would use data to show how the world has changed over the last 200 years or so. And what you see when you look at the data is that many of our conceptions about how the world has changed are upside down. So when you ask people whether global extreme poverty has risen or fallen, most people say it's risen. And actually, when you look at the data, it's fallen, and it's fallen a lot. And it's the same with most kind of human well-being metrics, that we've made amazing progress over the last few centuries. Now, that progress has obviously been very unequal. And it's not like we are done with that. It's not like we are in a position where we're happy with where we are. But we have made significant progress. Now, that was kind of left me in a weird position where many of the conceptions I had about the world, I realized, were completely wrong, especially in the kind of human well-being metrics. Now, all of the environmental metrics are still getting worse. I don't think Hans Rosling's work really changed my opinion on that. But it did show me that when we think about sustainability, we have had this tipping of the scales. It's not that just everything has gone in the wrong direction. We're incapable of solving problems. So we've kind of had this balance where our ancestors might have had a low environmental impact in the past, which is good, but the human well-being kind of metrics were probably pretty poor. What we've seen over the last few centuries is that balance tipping in the opposite direction. So we've made amazing progress on human well-being, but it's came at the cost of the environment. And the kind of proposal I put forward in the book is that we have the opportunity to be the first generation where I think we can do both of these things at the same time.
And so after you saw his work and you started potentially changing your mind, how did that lead you to where you are now in terms of your current day job?
Yeah, so I think a couple of things changed. I think one, he fundamentally changed my mindset. Not from I was really pessimistic and I was just thinking everything's amazing, because that was also not what Hans Rosling was trying to show, but more from a mindset of all of these problems are getting worse and there's nothing we can do about them, more into a problem-solving mindset. These are massive problems that we're facing, but we are capable of solving problems. How can I contribute to the solutions? And I think he also fundamentally changed kind of my career trajectory, or what I thought would be a useful contribution to the world, where I kind of probably saw myself as one, either like leaving environmental sciences behind completely or going down a very narrow academic route. And what I've done instead is to join the work at Our World in Data, where we basically take this approach and look at the big picture through data to understand these problems and how to solve them. So I think because he had a profound impact on me on a personal level of just how I view the world and my contribution, but also my mindset around, you know, career trajectory and where I can add value.
So at Our World in Data, your job is to kind of study what we already know, or what we could know if we looked at the data properly. How do you describe yourself? Do you describe yourself as a data scientist, or as someone who's kind of a translator of scientific, you know, work to to the rest of us? I mean, how do you think of, you know, when people ask you at a cocktail party, well, what's your job title? or what do you do? What do you say?
I kind of squirm and try to avoid the question. Yeah, it's actually quite hard to describe my job. Like I usually either say an environmental scientist or a data scientist. I actually think data scientist is more apt now because I do broader research than just environmental metrics. But yeah, like I would fundamentally see myself as kind of as a data scientist, but in a way that I also translate that data into a language that other people can understand. Like at Urban Data, we're a very diverse team with different skill sets. So some of us are more on the kind of academic side. So I'm partly based at the University of Oxford. But we're kind of misfits in that environment because we don't really do original research like most researchers do. We do this translation role where we try to bridge the gap between research and the general public, policymakers, journalists. So we rely on the amazing work that other researchers do. And we basically just try to translate it and make it more accessible so that it can get out there into the world so that people can use it to actually drive change.
So, you know, let's talk about some of those, some of the, I don't know, maybe misperceptions is the right word, or just, you know, trends that are kind of different than what we might expect. We had a guy called Larry Siegel on our show about a year and a half ago. He wrote a book called Fewer, Richer, Greener. And in that book, he talks about, you know, the trend that as countries grow richer, they get greener, right? They get better at managing their environment and emissions per person begin to fall. Total emissions keep going for a while because population grows, economies grow, but ultimately even total emissions start falling too. And, you know, you talk about that trend in your book as well, but you also provide some data that really was striking to me. And it seemed to show that developing countries are becoming greener faster now. I'm not sure if you agree with that or not, but I'm particularly thinking about the graph you had on coal emissions per person in China and India. And it was striking to me how rapidly that's declining. I was wondering if you could kind of describe what's happening there just as a kind of way, kind of an entree into, you know, how global emissions have developed.
Yeah. So if you look over history, like the biggest industrial producers have been today's rich countries. So the UK or the US, for example, if you plot over time, you know, our CO2 emissions or our coal emissions per person over time, 50 or so years ago, they were really, really high. And when you compare them to the emissions that you'd see per person in China or India today, they're way, way higher. You're talking like double, triple, quadruple the level that these emissions are today. Now, in rich countries, we have gone through this whole trajectory where our emissions increase very steeply. We reached this peak and now we're on the downward, and we're actually on the downward quite quickly. At lower levels of income, there are varying trends. Some countries are still growing very strongly, but many middle-income countries are kind of reaching this peak. Like China is a good example where coal emissions per person could be peaking right now at a much, much lower level than the UK or the US did. Now, that's good news. Basically, what that means is that we are able to develop economies in a much cleaner and low carbon way than we were in the past. If every country was going to go through the same trajectory that the UK or the US did, you know, tackling climate change would be impossible. Like, we just wouldn't be able to do it. What we are seeing is this development through technological change and through knowledge transfer, that countries further down the income distribution will be able to go through that whole pathway much faster and in a much cleaner way than rich countries did.
Yeah, I was kind of preparing for this interview, and I came across a couple recent articles in the FT. One said that China's energy capacity from renewables is now over 50%. In other words, its installed capacity of renewables could produce potentially more than half its power, and they're saying it's possible they could reach peak emissions before 2030, which was kind of striking to me, given what the narrative had been about, well, we don't really need to do anything, or we can't do anything about climate change because China's just burning a lot of coal and that's all that matters. That really seems to be changing.
Yeah, and it's changing very, very quickly. You're right that I think the narrative often in climate circles is, We shouldn't really do anything because China, it's all about China, and it's burning so much coal that, you know, what we do is completely insignificant. And it's true that China is burning a lot of coal and it is the world's largest emitter, but it is by far moving the quickest on clean energy. Like the pace by which it's installing solar and wind is just staggering. So last year it's installed enough solar and wind to power the entire UK or France. And that's just 1 year of installations. Last year, the amount of solar it installed was more than the US has built in its entire history. It's also moving really, really quickly on electric vehicles. Electric vehicles now, nearly 40% of new cars in China are electric. So it's moving really, really fast on these sectors. And I think a key reason for that is not just about climate. I think China also just sees that there's massive other benefits to this transition: economic opportunities, employment opportunities, energy security. And I think all of these are adding up to really shift many countries in that direction. I think in many ways, China's taking the lead on that, even though they have a pretty bad reputation in the climate space.
Yeah, it was just it's fascinating. And, you know, as I was reading about that and just listening to you now, the thing that popped into my mind is, okay, solar, wind, they are, you know, they're obviously great in terms of sustainability, but of course they have this intermittency problem. And what is China doing to manage that intermittency? Is it just, okay, we're going to burn coal to provide electricity when solar and wind aren't generating, or are they investing in, say, nuclear power to help with that?
I think a little bit of a mix of all of the above. I mean, China is also really one of the few countries that's still building nuclear at quite a large scale. Nuclear power has kind of fallen out of favor in many countries, and we're not really building it at any rate. China still is. It's still building nuclear power quite quickly. It has other things. So it has quite a lot of hydropower, which is also good for balancing out the kind of variability of solar and wind. It will also be a combination of kind of high voltage grid systems that basically allows you to transport electricity quite efficiently from one side of the country to the other. That might be an option in Europe, for example, where you could have this kind of European wide high voltage grid where you basically transfer electricity at different times in order to balance out some of the kind of intermittency of solar and wind. And then I think the final, you know, one other additional point is that batteries are also really rapidly falling in cost. And actually, China's driving quite a lot of that decline in cost. So that will be another part of the equation on much shorter timescales. You can't really use batteries, you know, over weeks or months, but you can use it over hours. And then I think the final thing, which is an interesting question on where China will go in terms of coal power, is that it's still true that China's building coal plants. And I think when people hear that China's still building coal plants, they automatically think, of course, that must mean that they're, you know, burning lots more coal. But it doesn't necessarily translate into burning more coal. What they're basically doing is kind of using coal power as these kind of peaker plants. So they only really turn on when it's very, very high demand. And they basically want to provide energy security. But there will be very long periods of time where these plants will be running at very low capacity or really not on at all. Like China has signed, you know, a bunch of kind of purchase agreements with coal plants where they will actually start to be paid not to be turned on. And there are like some projections that by the end of the decade, some of these plants will make more money from not running than they actually will from running. So I think China, like in the UK or other parts of Europe, for example, will often use gas as the kind of peak power. I think China is now going down the route of using coal instead.
Yeah, let's talk about that. But I just want to circle back to nuclear power. I mean, where do you see that playing a role in our kind of long-term sustainability future?
Yeah, I mean, nuclear power always tends to be quite a controversial topic. It seems to be either you're like really obsessed with it or you hate it.
And I should let you know that I grew up a few miles from the cooling towers at Three Mile Island. So I have a particular personal experience with that.
Yeah, so it is really controversial. And I think the big barrier there for the public is safety concerns. Actually, when you look at the history of nuclear, like deaths from nuclear disasters, and compare death rates to other sources of energy, nuclear energy is actually quite safe and has very low death rates. I think the key comparison there is that you're looking at, from fossil fuels, you know, millions of premature deaths every single year from local air pollution. And obviously the long-term impacts of climate change will ultimately also cost lives. So when you're comparing nuclear to fossil fuels, it's kind of a no-brainer, even in terms of safety. It's just that when we're thinking about fossil fuels and disasters there, we don't see the visible, you know, Three Mile Island or Chernobyl or Fukushima. They will have killed far, far fewer than fossil fuels, but it's much more visible to us. But I think in terms of where nuclear power is going, I think there are a couple of key constraints. I think the big one for many countries is costs. Now, in Asia, for example, so China or South Korea, they can actually build nuclear plants quite quickly without massive overruns and quite economically. We seem to be quite incapable of doing that now across Europe and North America. So where I see nuclear going in these environments is probably quite a low share of the power grid. But I think it could play like a crucial role, even as quite a small part of it. I think it could play quite a crucial role as this kind of stabilizer and base load to balance out some of the variable renewables that will dominate our energy systems over the next few decades. I mean, if you were to run kind of models of like a lowest cost model of, you know, by 2050, you know, what's the lowest cost grid we can build? Often there will be some nuclear in there. It may not be massive, but there is some nuclear in there as a kind of balancing out to get that final, you know, 10 or 15% of stability that you might lack with just solar or wind.
Given that, you know, we've still got that resistance to nuclear power and that, as you say, we don't seem to be able to build it in as cost-effective way as China or other Asian countries. Where does natural gas fit into the kind of sustainability framework in your mind? I mean, it's far cleaner than coal and oil. Do you see it as a kind of a good bridge to get us from, you know, I don't know, dirtier fossil fuels toward where we ultimately want to be?
I mean, I think in rich countries, it has already been playing a role as this bridge. I mean, if you look at the UK, for example, the transition we've had is that most of our power used to be run on coal. We then switched largely to gas, and then we're now switching from gas to renewables. So it has already played that bridge role. And I think from a climate perspective, that has probably been positive. I mean, the ideal would be you just go straight from coal to renewables. I think if you went back 10 or 15 years, renewables are really expensive. So I think it has been a relatively effective bridge there. I think the key point there is that, you know, it's time as a bridge is now up and we need to shift much faster away from it. I think the risk always with gas as a bridge is that it basically remains in the system for far too long and it kind of becomes a crux. So it becomes a permanent, you know, a permanent feature rather than a bridge where we quickly move to more low carbon sources of energy. But yeah, generally, if you're moving from coal to gas, the climate impacts and the local air pollution impacts are generally positive.
I think it's fair to characterize your kind of general prescription as electrify everything if you can, right? Cars, industry, heating, and then build as much, you know, nuclear and renewable power as you can to power them. If that's right, what's your take on, you know, the prospect for electric vehicles to solve that problem? You talk about emissions from transport, about just less than half comes from cars, motorcycles and buses, and then another 30% from trucks. So we're sort of looking at 75-80% of transport emissions coming from those sources. Can we get to a point where, you know, that's pretty much all coming from electric vehicles in your mind?
Yeah, I think this electrification process is really crucial. Yeah, I think your summary of my position is correct. Basically, it's electrify as much as we can and then find alternatives to the remaining factor. I think there are two key reasons for that. One is that we know how to decarbonize electricity. So if you electrify transport, you know, we have a solution by which we can electrify it, decarbonize our electricity systems. So that's one key one. And then the other massive benefit to electrification is that you get these massive efficiency gains, such that when you switch from a petrol or diesel car, for example, to an electric car, or a gas boiler to an electric heat pump, you get massive efficiency gains. Basically, what that means is that to travel the same distance in your car or to get the same heat from a heat pump, you need much, much less energy. So overall, we're going to actually reduce our energy demand rather than increase it. When it comes to electrification of transport, yeah, I think the move to electric cars is at this point almost inevitable. I think the cost of these technologies is falling quite quickly, and I think will continue to fall, largely because of just massive improvements in battery technologies, both in terms of cost, but also range and functionality. That's improved massively. And as you say, like the gains there in efficiency are really pretty massive. If you look at a petrol car, for example, for every dollar of gasoline that you put in it, only around 20 cents actually goes towards turning the wheels. The other 80 cents is completely wasted as heat, right? You don't get any benefit from that whatsoever. When you're powering an electric car, it's almost the opposite. So for every dollar of electricity you use, 80 cents go towards turning the wheels and only 20 cents are lost. Now, what that means is that to travel the same distance in an electric car, you use 3 to 4 times less energy than you would in a petrol car. So these efficiency gains from electrification are really, really, really massive. And I think is one of the reasons why I think this transition is just at this point inevitable. The timescale is always debatable, but I think inevitable because we are just moving towards a much better system.
How do you respond to some of the criticism of electric vehicles? Like, you know, if you kind of look at the full emissions generated in mining the materials for batteries, putting the batteries together, shipping the cars because they're heavier, even the extra damage to roads because the electric vehicles are heavier. I mean, these are all, you know, what I liked about your book is that it takes a very broad perspective on a lot of problems. How do you think about that?
Yeah, so I often get the question of the carbon footprint of an electric vehicle versus a gasoline car, because people know quite rightly that producing the electric car, like producing the battery and producing the body of the electric car, actually at this point emits more than it does to produce a gasoline car. So if you were to produce an electric car versus a gasoline car and not drive it at all, then yes, your electric car would be worse. But what's key then is that once you start driving the car, it really doesn't take that long before your carbon benefits pay off. Like basically the electric car pays off its carbon debts pretty quickly. That tends to be, partly depends on how often and how far you drive. But for the average in the UK, for example, it's less than 2 years. So after 2 years, you'll then be massively reducing carbon emissions compared to the gasoline car. And I think the really crucial factor there is that this equation will only improve over time. The emissions of your electric car after it's been built depend on the emissions of your electricity grid. And the UK or the US or most countries are going to move towards much lower carbon electricity. So actually, if you buy an electric car today, 5 or 10 years from now, it will actually be much cleaner than it is today because your country will reduce the carbon intensity of its electricity grid.
Yeah, I appreciate that perspective. I'm a driver of electric cars, and I have been for a long time. And it's interesting how as soon as someone brings up a criticism, you can kind of think of the counterexample. I mean, we always hear about range anxiety, and there is some. But you know, I remember when I drove petrol cars, I had a lot of like petrol station anxiety. Like, when do I have to go in? You know, I get up in the morning, I'm driving to work, and I find my daughter had the car the night before and drove it right down to empty. And so, you know, there's a lot of things. And also, I don't spend any time at petrol stations now, which is, you know, I get that part of my life back. So
Yeah, I think there's lots of very like valid questions and criticisms on many of these technologies and the transition overall. And I think the key point there is there's always a bit of truth to them, right? Like there is true that, you know, producing the battery in an electric car does just use more energy and emit more carbon. It is true that, you know, there will be fringe cases where range anxiety is a thing, but I think the role of data and what I try to do with my work is to put that into context so people can see that, you know, compared to what is an important question to ask. So when you're looking at the carbon footprint of an electric car, okay, it's not zero, but compared to a gasoline car, it's much, much, much lower. So I think that framing of the context within data is really, really important.
Let's kind of pick up on that theme and talk about another big area, which is kind of the food system. And you've got a really fascinating table, for, I think, toward the end of your chapter on climate change, where you say, okay, here's the kind of the actual climate impact of various actions we could take, giving up SUVs or avoiding flights, recycling, things like that. Here's the actual climate impact. And then here's the perceived climate impact from surveys. And to me, it seemed like the biggest gap between kind of actual and perceived came in the impact of adopting a plant-based diet. It was the, according to your data, the third most effective, you know, climate impact, yet it was perceived as being not that important by most people. So maybe you could explain a little bit more about why a plant-based diet is so climate friendly. Why does it have such a big impact?
Yeah, I think that's correct. I think when people think about climate and their carbon footprint, they automatically just think of energy. So they think of, you know, my car, my plane, they think of plastics like recycling, and they kind of forget about food because it's quite hard to link back how does food contribute to climate change. But actually food systems emit around between a quarter and a third of our greenhouse gas emissions. So they do play like quite a significant role. And we actually won't tackle climate change unless we also tackle our food systems. Obviously, we need to move away from fossil fuels. But, you know, if we maintain the food system we have today, we actually won't be able to tackle climate change. In terms of the carbon footprint of different food products, yeah, if you look at a graph of, you know, the carbon emissions per, and you can do it by any metric, per kilogram, per gram of protein, per calorie, what you tend to find is that animal-based products, so meat or dairy, are really near the top. They have much higher emissions, and plant-based products tend to be much lower to the bottom. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One key one is that meat products, in particular like cattle raising, so for beef or dairy, tend to need a lot of land. And that often means deforestation or habitat loss or, you know, creeping into to other wild grasslands, which obviously has a climate cost, right? If you're cutting down forests, that emits carbon. The other big one there, especially for cattle, is that cattle have this process which we call enteric fermentation. So they basically burp out methane. And methane is a really powerful greenhouse gas. So that's a big contributor to its carbon footprint. And I think the final point is that producing meat is just a really inefficient process. When you think about the amount of crops you need to feed animals to get a small amount of meat in return, it's really, really big. And when you're thinking about the carbon footprint of these products, you need to take into account all of the carbon footprint of the crops that they're eating or other grains that they're eating. And that's a massive contributor to their total carbon footprint. So yes, when you look at a ranking of foods by carbon footprint, meats tend to be at the top and plant-based products tend to be at the bottom.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that section. And there was some, I don't know what the right phrasing is here, maybe inconvenient truths in there, in that, you know, you say, hey, actually, when you look at the emissions from, you know, say from beef, organic processes are actually much worse or worse. And the reason is they take up, you know, a lot more land. You know, a grass fed cattle ranch is going to require more grazing area. You know, how do people react when you tell them that? And you also say, actually, that I think you tell a nice story about going back to your old university, and one of your old professors was talking about how she only ate, locally raised lamb because that was more sustainable. And you kind of bit your tongue a little. I don't think you said anything at the time, but that's also not typically the case. So why is, maybe just elaborate a little bit on why organic farming methods and locally raised, meat isn't really as sustainable as we might think.
Yeah, I mean, on your question of how people react, the answer is not very well. A lot of people just don't like this message, but it's what the data tells us. Like on the local food point, I think, you ask people, what's the best way to reduce the carbon footprint of your diet? They tend to say eat local, which I understand the rationale for. We know that transporting stuff emits CO2, right? So transporting stuff by truck or plane or ship obviously emits CO2. Therefore, you'd assume the stuff that travels furthest to reach me obviously has the highest carbon footprint. I think what people get wrong there is that when we look at the breakdown of emissions from food systems, globally transport only makes up around 5%. Most of the emissions from our food come from land use change or using the land or emissions on the farm. So that's stuff like fertilizers, manure, the cows burping, tractors, and actually the transport component for most products is actually pretty small. Now, what that means is that when you break down the emissions of, say, local lamb, they still have a higher carbon footprint than, your soy or avocados shipped in from South America. So this just doesn't stack up when you look at the data that local food is necessarily the best to reduce your carbon footprint. What I always say is that what you eat and how it's produced matters much, much more than how far it's traveled to reach you. Now, the caveat to that is that that doesn't mean, you shouldn't eat local food. There are a bunch of reasons why someone would want to eat local, whether it's, supporting local farmers or they want to see the animal welfare standards that they're buying meat from. But it's just to say, if you're doing it entirely on the basis of carbon footprint, that's not necessarily the case that you're doing the most optimal thing to achieve that. On the organic farming, again, it's a little bit of a mixed picture, where if you look at the environmental impacts of organic versus more, conventional agriculture, there's often no clear winner, or sometimes organic comes out worse. So on land use, for example, organic tends to come out worse because you tend to get lower yields, which means you need to use more land to produce the same amount of food. Now, that's bad for carbon, that's bad for wild habitats, that's bad for deforestation. So I think the notion that, organic is necessarily best for the environment just doesn't stack up again when you look at the data.
There was another, inconvenient truth that I sort of learned reading your book, which had to do with indoor farming. So indoor farming, sometimes called vertical farming, that's basically growing food indoors, often in urban warehouses using LED lights, and you basically add nutrients to the water instead of soil. And, that sounds exceptionally promising, right? The yields, as far as I understand, can be quite a bit higher, require less land, and the food is grown close to where it's consumed. So it seems, on the face of it, to be something that could contribute to sustainability, but you're pretty skeptical of that. Why is that?
Yeah, I'm pretty skeptical. I mean, there are massive benefits, potentially, if you could get this to work. Like, you would massively reduce fertilizer use. You would also obviously massively reduce land use. You would also develop a food system which is much, much less vulnerable to climate impacts and weather shocks. Like, producing food outdoors is just really bad in a changing climate, which is what we're going to face. So it may also make our food system just much, much more resilient. The reason I'm skeptical about this, especially on shorter timescales, is, one, the variety of the crops that you can produce. So this is only really proven to be effective, say, for kind of leafy greens or vegetables. And the reason for that is that you can get a reasonable premium for those products on the market. So you can just about get the economics of those products to work. although I should say that there have been a number of companies have gone bust recently trying to do this. And the reason for that was that there was a spike in energy costs. With indoor farming, you're basically substituting land for energy. And that means that your indoor farming system is really vulnerable to the cost of energy. And if the energy cost spikes, then a lot of products are just not feasible. The economics currently just really, really don't work for the crops where we get most of our calories from. So cereals, pulses, grains, the economics of those products just really don't work at the moment. So I'm pretty skeptical about indoor farming over, you know, the timescale of the next, you know, 10, 20 years. If we can get to a stage where we can produce really abundant energy, really low carbon and really, really cheaply, then yeah, vertical farming could be a really promising solution, but I don't see it being a big part of our food system in the next decade, for example.
Got it. Yeah, I guess if we're in a situation where we can produce low carbon energy in abundance at low cost, then not that we wouldn't need indoor farming, but we've already gone a long way to kind of solving the issues anyway. Let's talk about one more area that I think people stress a lot about that you address, you know, in a really interesting way, which is plastic and plastic waste. You make the point that there are actually some significant environmental upsides to plastic. So I'm wondering if maybe you could just outline those first, just so we kind of all, you know, aware of that there are benefits there.
Yeah, I mean, the world produces so much plastic, which many people see as a negative, and sometimes it is a negative. I think it's important to acknowledge the reason we produce so much plastic is because it's actually just a really amazing material. It's really versatile, it's really sanitary, it's really cheap, it's really flexible. That's exactly why we use so much of it, because it's just so beneficial in so many different environments. If you look at kind of, even if you look at, you know, the medical industry, like, how would you be able to run a sterile medical environment without plastic? You know, how would we have dealt with the COVID pandemic without plastic for, you know, our vaccines or plastic masks? So I think plastic does play a really pivotal role in most industries today. And I think it does have various environmental benefits. I mean, we always see the plastic packaging around our foods. And although in many senses that's overdone, and I'm sure we could massively cut down the amount of plastic that we use, it is there for a reason. It tends to preserve shelf life. It protects your food from diseases or pests and makes it more safe. And if you didn't have that plastic there, you could argue that we actually would have higher levels of food waste than we currently do. And that would obviously have a much bigger environmental cost than just the plastic itself. So I think there's like a balance there where I think we can cut back on plastics. I think we do overuse them. But I think we also fail to acknowledge that sometimes the plastic is useful and it's actually there for a reason.
Yeah, you talk about that, reducing food waste, and then, you know, that cuts back on CO2 emissions because less food has to be produced. And you also talk about, you know, usage in transport. That's a very light material. And if we didn't have it, then we'd be transporting things in heavier containers, which also uses more CO2. So, from your perspective, I think the real issue is how we handle plastic waste and how we, in particular, how we stop it from getting in the ocean, getting in the water systems. You talk about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch not too far off the coast from where I live in California. That's basically an area three times the size of France where discarded plastic is just accumulated in this giant patch in the ocean. But you're actually, I think, fairly optimistic that we can deal with the problem of plastic waste getting into our water systems. Why is that, if I've characterized it correctly?
Yeah, that's correct. And I think I should say that there are two problems with plastic. There's the overarching question of microplastics and what are the impacts of microplastics on human health. Like, we've all seen so many stories now about how many particles are in our water bottles, or, you know, we know that microplastics are just everywhere. I think the really open question is, what, if any, impact does that have on human health? And I think that's a really important but totally wide open question. If we're looking for solutions on how we stop plastic completely so we don't have microplastics, I don't have the answer to that. I don't know how to do that. But the question of plastics leaking into the rivers and leaking into the ocean is a much more tractable problem. And I actually think this is a problem we could solve with a global scale, relatively minor investments of money into waste management. So when you look at the breakdown of where plastics in rivers and the ocean come from, it's not necessarily about how much plastic we use, it's about how it's managed at the end of the chain. If your plastic is going into a sealed landfill or going to recycling or going to incineration, it's not ending up in the ocean. The issue is that many countries don't have sufficient waste management infrastructure to handle all of the waste that's being generated. So plastic waste leaking into rivers and the ocean tends to be highest in middle to low income countries where people are rich enough to use more and more plastic, but the waste management infrastructure is not there to tackle it. Now, that's a very tractable problem. We know that if we just built landfills there or built recycling systems or incineration systems, that problem would essentially be solved. It's just the issue is that it's not high enough on the priority list for countries to want to do that or want to do that in the very, very short term. There are a couple of flashier or more exciting projects than just building a landfill, which show some promise. So there's the Ocean Cleanup Project, which was founded by Boyan Slat, and it is basically there to try to clean up the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. Like, we always talk about the plastics flowing into the ocean, but what they're actually trying to do is take out the plastic that's already there. And I think they are making some progress on that. Like, I think it's not like a solved problem, but they are making some progress on that. And what they're also doing is this other project, which is more focused on stopping plastic going into the ocean in the first place. Now, the idea was that we would build really effective waste management systems and sealed landfills and recycling centres. But since that's not very, very high on the agenda, basically this team are building what they call interceptors. So they basically build this kind of technology or this machinery at the roof, at the mouth of rivers. So they catch the plastic before it goes into the ocean. And they're specifically targeting these really high density rivers where most of the plastics are flowing in. And they're basically trying to catch it before it leaks into the ocean and it's much harder to get out. So I think to me, yeah, this is a very, very tractable problem. It's just really about our willingness to invest some money into solving it.
That's really fascinating. What idea that I had is that, we often hear that a rich countries kind of ship their plastic waste to developing countries. And now, of course, there's been a big pushback from developing countries on that. But, you know, given what you've said of, you know, richer countries have much more well-established and more efficient waste management systems, why not do the reverse? Why not import plastic waste from, you know, poorer countries into Western countries where the waste management system is better and it can be handled? I mean, couldn't that be like an economic, you know, business? I guess it wouldn't be politically very popular, but is that possible?
I think the challenge there would be that from the country that the plastic waste is coming from, you would still need like infrastructure there to gather the waste. So you would still need the infrastructure there to gather the waste, transport it to, I don't know, a dock or wherever it's going to come from, and then to transport it. So the incentives on the other side might not necessarily be there. But I think for me, like from kind of rich country government perspective, I mean, in the UK, I kind of criticise in the book, you know, we make a massive deal out of policies like banning plastic straws, which, you know, seem very visible and, you know, it looks like we're doing a lot to tackle this problem, but, you know, it's so insignificant and it's doing almost nothing to solve this problem. For me, like, the biggest thing there for rich countries would be, you know, one, to stop the tiny amounts of plastic that we still have, you know, leaking into the ocean, to stop that. But first and foremost, one, don't transport and export our waste to countries that don't have waste management infrastructure, or just invest in waste management infrastructure in these countries. Like, that would be much, much more impactful than these kind of visible but kind of meaningless programs to like ban plastic straws.
Yeah, and that's a theme that really, that I think that comes through very clearly in your book of, you know, what matters and what doesn't. I wanted maybe just in the last sort of 10 minutes to ask a couple personal questions if I could. So I guess we all filter data through our own kind of political or personal lens, right? I want certain things to happen. I want other things not to happen. And so when I get data that confirms what I want, I kind of remember it. It's salient to me. And then stuff that, you know, that is uncomfortable, I downplay it. And I feel like that's a challenge that we all face. But I imagine that's particularly difficult for you because your job literally is to, you know, interpret data. How do you, I mean, I guess number one, do you feel that? And number two, if you do, how do you deal with it? And I'm asking in part because a lot of our listeners are investors or come from the investment world. And I think the best investors see the world as it is, not how they want it to be. And it seems like that's kind of what what you have to do every day. So I'm kind of curious how you tackle that problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a difficult problem. Like, I think, as you say, we do go looking for stuff that confirms our biases and stuff that pushes us in a direction that we want to go. And I wouldn't say that I'm immune from that in any way. Like, I obviously struggle with that. I think there are a couple of things that I try to do to keep me in check. I think one thing that I think is a benefit in this role is just simply curiosity. I think many of the big questions that I tackle in my work or I tackle in the book, I think it's less motivated by I want this outcome, let me go and find some papers that back my idea and back this up. I think it's more driven by there's this really annoying question that's bothering me because I don't know the answer to it. Let me go out and find the answer. And I'm going to accept the answer that I find. I'm not going to go looking specifically for the answer that I want to find. So I think this curiosity and being open to just finding whatever answer is out there rather than finding a specific outcome that you want is really important. I think what's also really important is just having like good people around you, like good, honest people that will give you constructive feedback. I think that's really valuable about our team at Our Odds and Data. We do all come from like slightly different backgrounds. Like I think we're unified around the mission. You know, we want to understand the world's largest problems and we want to, you know, inform people on how we can best tackle them. So we share that vision, but I think we come from different backgrounds and we have pretty different perspectives. I mean, there's not really anyone else in the team necessarily that's strictly from an environmental background. Like on the research team, for example, I work with economists and people in the health space, and they don't necessarily come to this with the same biases from an environmental perspective that I do. So getting really clear and honest feedback from them on where I might be, you know, pushing too far one way, or I might not be completely honest with myself, is really, really valuable. But I think in that scenario, you really need to trust those people's opinions and perspectives and take them very, very seriously. But no, I totally agree. Like it is just an issue, and you do need to constantly try to keep yourself in check. I mean, a good idea is just always to try and steel man your ideas. Like what would be the strongest criticism that anyone could come up with that would push against this article that I'm writing or this data that I'm presenting? And I think that's just essential to do that process over and over and over.
So what are the annoying questions, or what is the main annoying question that you're trying to find an answer to right now?
I think one fundamental question that I'm thinking about a lot, and I think is really crucial for us in the energy transition, and I want to be true, but I'm just not sure if it is true, is you often hear, I mean, we discussed it a little bit earlier, it's about the speed of the transition and the pathways of low, middle and low-income countries compared to rich countries. And you often hear this referred to as leapfrogging. So there's this concept that, you know, poorer countries, they can just skip, you know, all the bad stuff that rich countries had to go through and just leapfrog to this amazing new technology on the other side. And people talk about the leapfrogging concept a lot. And I think we often imagine that it's easy and it's true. But there's actually very few examples from history that you can look at where there's just this really, really clear leapfrogging effect. think the only one when we have looked at the data that's just super clear is landline phones. So low-income countries, you know, basically never really had a landline phone. They just skipped straight to mobile phone. Now, in the energy transition, you know, I would love it to be true that low-income countries just wouldn't need fossil fuels, right? They could just jump straight from, you know, burning wood or charcoal straight to solar and wind, and there'd just be absolutely no need for any fossil fuels. I don't know if that's true. And I think it will take some time for the data to play out for us to really understand what that transition looks like. Like, I'm pretty convinced they will move through a development pathway in a much cleaner way than rich countries did. But I'm still a little bit skeptical of this, you know, complete clean leapfrog that, you know, I would like to be true, but we just don't really have any data to support.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So it's, I kind of agree with you. I think it's more likely that you just have an acceleration of the typical path, which is, seems like what we talked about earlier with China and India moving much quicker, you know, through the fossil fuel stage to a renewable stage. Well, listen, Hannah, thanks so much for joining us. It's really been a fascinating conversation. I highly recommend the book. It's called Not the End of the World. And if you want to follow Hannah's regular publication, her Substack is Sustainability by Numbers. So Hannah, thanks again for joining us, and we wish you all the best.
Oh, thanks so much. I really enjoyed the chat.
Great. And with that, I'm going to pass it back over to Niels.
Thank you so much, Hannah and Kevin, for an absolutely fascinating look into how we may be able to achieve a more sustainable future, which is a nice and optimistic outlook to have. What I love about the conversation is that Hannah started out with a completely opposite view of the future, having a profound pessimistic outlook, but through data-driven work, have changed her mindset and view of the future of our planet. I think the most surprising thing I got from the conversation was Hannah's view on how much China is doing when it comes to the green technology, despite still burning a lot of coal, which admittedly took me by surprise. So if this really is the case, then the title of her book, Not the End of the World, How We Can Be the First Generation to Build a Sustainable Planet, really is very fitting and should give us all hope despite all the negative news we get from mainstream media. Of course, only time will tell. Make sure you go and follow Hannah's and Kevin's work, as well as getting a copy of the books, because as you can tell from today's conversation, some of these ideas and topics may not be discussed enough on mainstream media. From Kevin and me, thank you so much for listening. We look forward to being back with you on the next episode. And in the meantime, take care of yourself and take care of each other.
Thanks for listening to Top Traders Unplugged. If you feel you learned something of value from today's episode, the best way to stay updated is to go on over to iTunes and subscribe to the show so that you'll be sure to get all the new episodes as they're released. We have some amazing guests lined up for you, and to ensure our show continues to grow, please leave us an honest rating and review in iTunes. It only takes a minute, and it's the best way to show us you love the podcast. We'll see you next time on Top Traders Unplugged.